From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Citizen stewardship. That's the rubric the Bush administration is using to promote its new vision for the environment. That is, industry and private citizens will voluntarily reduce pollution and enhance conservation. This week, administration officials are crisscrossing the country, seeking to convince industries to voluntarily curb emissions of gases linked to global warming. Environmentalists say voluntarism won't work. They charge that the president is watering down the country's basic environmental regulations on water and air pollution, wetlands and wildlands, fish and wildlife. Wetlands, they say, don't contribute to political campaigns. Polluters do. What grade do you give Bush on the environment? Do you think his voluntary approach will work? Should the economy take precedence over the environment in an economic downturn? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Brent Blackwelder, president of Friends of the Earth, a nonprofit lobbying group that promotes environmental interests. He's been an environmental lobbyist for 33 years. Welcome. Thank you.
I'm glad to be with you tonight.
Well, we're glad to have you. Let's begin with man bites dog. Say a good word or two about the administration's record. People have just talked about, for example, on diesel fuel and on the Colorado River.
Well, I really don't have anything very good to say about Bush because in the 33 years that I've watched all the different Republican and Democrat administrations come and go, there's never been anything like the volume of rollbacks of basic environmental protections.
And we want to get at that. I just did want you to sort of begin by saying, well, it isn't all
bad. In some cases, they've cracked down on some air pollution in North Dakota, for example, and they will go part of the way to try to make some boats and motors cleaner.
This is the diesel.
20-some years.
This is the diesel fuel regulation?
This is for motorbikes and boats and so forth. So there are a few areas where they may have taken some action, but overall, if you're talking about enforcement or talking about trying to make progress, because what we're really after here are clean air for our families to breathe. We want to get rid of the asthma that's plaguing the country. We don't want half of our bodies of water to be still polluted. We don't want our beaches to be unfit for swimming or fishing. So we've got a lot of jobs in front of us. And what is happening now is that in every one of these areas, instead of moving forward and making progress, we're actually seeing the programs that we're working being rolled back, compromised.
Okay, we have exhausted your ecumenical impulse. Take us just since the November election, just since November, what steps has the Bush administration taken on the environment, and why are they the wrong steps?
But let's just look at water, for example. They finalized a rule on gigantic factory farms that really stinks. These are gigantic operations that produce 220 billion gallons of manure a year, and they're legalizing various polluting discharges into already polluted bodies of water. Those are going to only get worse. They're giving the industry write-your-own permits. They are proposing most significantly in water to restrict the coverage of the Clean Water Act so that some 20 million acres of wetlands would not be covered. Tributaries of major rivers might not be covered under these rules that they're proposing. It would be a massive way of stepping back from the job that remains. In the case of air pollution, instead of moving forward to deal with these dirty power plants, they are actually under euphemism clean skies, not going to require the latest in technology. It's sort of a Luddite charge that might be leveled against the administration instead of requiring best technology.
And this is just since the election, since the November election.
This is right at the end of November. I'm talking about that, and they proposed a massive exemption for the National Forest from our fundamental procedural law, the National Environmental Policy Act, which passed under the Nixon administration in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
So in almost every area you look, you've had very, very significant action since the November election on air, on water, and on forests.
Let's go back now to the other election, the 2000 election. What did Mr. Bush say on the environment, and how true has he been to his campaign promises?
He said on the campaign trail that we have a duty of stewardship and that he would pursue that. He said he would carry out his father's pledge of no net loss of wetlands. Friends of the Earth thinks that he's broken these promises in his most flagrant manner that you could imagine. I mean, we're not talking about one or two. We're talking about major revisions of the cornerstone laws that protect the health of the American public.
So he ran saying that he would uphold these laws, and you say he's weakening them.
Yes, very significantly so. And the only thing stopping the weakening is if you can get a court injunction.
Mm-hmm.
For example, that has happened in the case of the proposal to legalize the dumping of waste from mining into rivers.
Mm-hmm.
This had been prohibited by the Clean Water Act, but the administration reversed that last May. However, the court and Judge Hayden in West Virginia will not allow the overturning of this law, the regulation implementing the law. So right now the administration wants to say it's okay to dump waste into our rivers, which has never been allowed as a purpose of, as a means of getting rid of waste, and we'll have to see where that comes out.
Also in the election campaign, didn't the president say something about carbon dioxide gases, that he was going to do something?
Indeed, the President Bush said that candidate Bush at that time said that he would take action to reduce greenhouse gases, and carbon dioxide is the most significant of the gases that are changing the Earth's climate. Right now, though, instead of getting a mandatory program, he has walked away from the global agreement, the so-called Kyoto Protocol, and is saying, let's go with a voluntary approach.
Mm-hmm.
The basic problem with a voluntary approach, though, is that he is also providing huge amounts of tax subsidy and incentives that go to the big polluters.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no track record since the 1960s of industry voluntarily moving forward. It's only when basic standards have been set. First, the states tried it, and then we finally had to get them at a nationwide level. Otherwise, states would play one another off against each other. And that's why we finally came to the Clean Air and Clean Water Act in 1970 and 1972. That was the only way we could make progress.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there's a politics to this, too, isn't there? I mean, last year, Jerry Seib, one of the most reputable reporters in America, had what I thought was quite a scoop, which was the thinking of Karl Rove about environmental politics. And basically, Karl Rove looks at a map and he says, well, you know, we're not going to get the coasts. We're not going to get those green beanies, as he calls environmentalists. But we don't need them. We got the plain states. We got and we get a free electoral vote in each one. More cows than people. We have West Virginia. Oh, certainly New Hampshire is going to be with us the next time. And first, we're certainly going to have Florida. We don't need them. And you know what? We can run against the environment in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania, Michigan and West Virginia. That's a tough argument, isn't it, to refute?
Well, he can say they're going to run against the environment, but they don't. They couch every proposal as a healthy forest proposal, as a clear skies proposal, because they know the American public would be revolted by an attempt, an admission that that's exactly what is going on.
But that's the strategy, right?
Furthermore, though, most candidates ran on a pro-environment platform. Even some that had very bad records boasted that they had great records.
Mm-hmm.
So no one that I know of is running overtly on an anti-environmental platform. They think, though, that they can do it and reward their friends because, as we know, in every area, those factory farm rules, they got Tons of money from the agribusiness lobby. In the energy area, they got millions and millions from the major coal and oil companies. And so, therefore, they propose an energy bill that has heavy subsidies and favors for them. That is, it's they're running it, the government, not as if we should do things that are in the interest of all Americans, but rather in the interest of the major companies that have done the most to contribute to our campaign.
Sure, but, you know, when you look at it and you say to a fellow in West Virginia, I'm sure you've been there, I have relatives there, that's a very poor state. And you say to those people, either explicitly or through your campaign propaganda, you know, those people in the East have got great ideas about what should happen here with these power plants and coal plants and everything else, but you folks have got to work, and we're not going to let them just shut you down. And,
no, that's but that's but that's a very phony argument. In fact, the coal industry, as a result of mechanization, has fewer and fewer laborers involved in it. You have major transnational coal companies who, this very day, are blowing the tops off mountains. I know because last summer I was in West Virginia. We flew a small plane out of Charleston. As you go south, you see the most incredible pollution I've seen in my life in the United States. Mm. They're blowing the tops off the mountains. There's not a tree left. They're dumping the rubble down the valleys. And then the people that live below are experiencing severe flooding. I think it's morally unacceptable to say we're going to save certain coal jobs at the expense of destroying the jobs and livelihoods of innocent people who live throughout the state. And coal is becoming less and less a component of the job market there because of the mechanization. So why not actually mine coal in an environmentally sound manner and spend some money that's there on rehabilitation and restoration of those devastated watersheds?
I'm just saying that economic anxiety runs high there. Let's get an administration spokeswoman in here. Lynn Scarlett, welcome. She's the Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Policy, Management, and Budget. Can you defend this record, Lynn Scarlett?
You betcha, and I'd like to say good evening to Brent, a longtime acquaintance.
Yes, good evening.
You know, there are different lenses that one can bring to these issues, and let's just take the wetlands issue that Brent mentioned. He talked about the recent wetlands rule, of course.
What was that rule?
What that rule did was there was a court decision some short time ago which said that the Clean Water Act wetland provisions did not apply to, for example, in this particular case, a quarry. It was a mined quarry that after it was done being used for that purposes, a county wanted to use it for a landfill, and it was argued that they needed to get a permit for wetlands. And the court actually ruled that no, an abandoned mine or abandoned quarry was not, in fact, a wetland. So we had to come in and bring some clarity and definition to just exactly when did the Clean Water Act apply or not, and attempted to do so consistent with that court ruling. But I'd like to broaden the horizons here and just suggest to you that the whole focus on that wetlands rule and on the Clean Water Act really misses the big picture in terms of environmental protection and wetlands protection. Through those regulatory programs, over the past decade, for each year, we've protected about 20,000 acres of wetlands net. We have a vision that the best way to protect wetlands is, in fact, through partnerships, through citizen stewardship, through voluntary programs, through cooperative partnerships. So we're putting a big emphasis on our Partners for Fish and Wildlife program, for example. That program, and we're going to be proposing a new big increase to it as this next 2004 budget rolls out. That program, just in 2001-2000, actually saved over 100,000 acres, five times as many acres as the regulatory program.
Lynn, we want to come right back to you and hear more about that. We're just going to pause now. We're talking about the Bush environmental record this hour. Call us with your questions. How would you score it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're scoring, after 2 years, the Bush record on the environment, and we're interested in your thoughts. What grade would you give him on the environment? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Brent Blackwelder. He's the president of the Friends of the Earth, and with Lynn Scarlett. She's the Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Policy, Management, and Budget. And before the break, Lynn Scarlett, you were getting into the nitty-gritty of some of these regulations. Can you back up, though, and tell us what is the George Bush worldview on the environment? It has to do with the view between the market and the environment. What is it? If you get inside Bush's head, what's there? What is his big picture?
I think the big picture of the administration is one that really says, look, if we're going to have a positive environmental future, we have to engage citizens. Mm-hmm. That means we have to engage them as partners, as volunteers. We have to go forward with cooperative conservation endeavors, because ultimately it's only when we have that kind of peaceful problem solving that we will have sustainable outcomes. So, for example, Secretary Norton, with whom I work at the Department of the Interior, has put forth what she calls her four C's: conservation through cooperation, communication, and consultation. I think that very much exemplifies a vision that President Bush himself has. It's also a vision focused on results. It's a vision that recognizes that you can stack up all the regulations you want, but in the end, the real question is, are we doing better? And this is what gets me back to that wetlands issue. So much of the brouhaha and focus in recent weeks on the Wetlands Mitigation and Clean Water Act has been on this small set of acres that are handled through that act, when completely off the radar screen are this 100,000 acres that our Partners for Fish and Wildlife program has accomplished in a single year. Or consider the recent Farm Bill with its $17 billion increase with much support by the administration for conservation purposes. Under that, it's expected that we'll have another 1 million acres in short time that are created through that kind of program.
So
this dwarfs the regulatory effort.
So his approach is you're going to get – he wants the same goals as people who are friends of the earth, but he wants to get them through voluntary means, through partnerships, not through litigation. But doesn't he at some level also just think that environmental regulation has impeded the economy?
You know, there's no one-size-fits-all here. This is an administration that embraces a whole suite of options, and they range from the voluntary, the partnerships that we describe. They range from investments in technology and financial investments. We have $4.1 billion, with a B, dollars invested, for example, in climate change research. That dwarfs what just about any other country around the world is investing. And then there are regulations. This is an administration that, when it looked at the science and the impacts on human health, held up and moved forward with the diesel regulation to reduce particulates and other pollutants from diesel trucks and so on. So there's a whole range, and they go from the regulatory through the investment in technology and other innovations, and then to the voluntary and the partnership.
Mm-hmm. Brent Blackwelder, how about that record, partnerships for a cleaner environment? Partnerships presumably with industries that pollute or that could.
Look, no one has a problem if you can get a voluntary program going with business. That's great. But this completely bypasses the bad actor problem. It pretends that companies like Enron don't exist in the world. In every mm-hmm. category of business, we all know that there are major polluters at work, people that do not have high moral standards, and if they can get away with it, they will. The purpose of these laws is to protect everybody, including business themselves, who spend money to comply from people who don't comply.
Mm-hmm. And, of course,
and
Brent,
the second point,
Brent, that is exactly why we put forth a whole suite of options, and they include the regulatory. It's why we have, for example, the diesel rule with a strong backstop. The Clean Skies Initiative, to which you alluded and were concerned about, will actually reduce 35 million tons of pollutants, reduced by 70% over 10 years existing pollutants, and it will have a backstop. It is a regulatory program that says thou shalt not pollute beyond these amounts. So it is a strong regulatory component. But we realize that you cannot anchor environmental success in the kind of prescriptive and punitive approaches that are so tied with the kinds of regulations we've had the last 30 years. You've got to move beyond that, and that's what we're seeking to do.
There are a lot of folks who want to get in on this. Let's begin with Greg calling from Geneva, Pennsylvania. Hello, and thank you for calling On Point.
Hello.
What's your question, please?
Well, actually, not so much a question. I just wanted to I work in an environmental laboratory. We test a lot of water, and I'm aware of some of the regulation as it exists.
Yep.
And mostly I just wanted to say to the proposal by the Bush administration to do this on a voluntary basis, I don't really think that's going to work in the long run unless there's some type of an incentive there. Most of our clientele I know come to us because we can provide the service that they are required to get through either state or federal regulation. They don't come to us because they like us or they love us or anything else. They simply come to us because we provide it at the lowest cost. And in business, that's the bottom line. And I think there may be some advantages in getting companies to, or industry, to try and recycle and reclaim some of the pollutants that I see.
Yes.
Because they're often processed chemicals that can be reused.
Mm-hmm.
But those type of recycling efforts are very expensive, and again, they're not going to do them on their own, and maybe some, tax breaks or grant money type incentives would be required to move it in that direction.
So you're talking about that kind of incentives, tax incentives to have industries recycle, especially chemicals, but then you're also implying that we need regulations to sort of force them to comply. Is that it?
Right, because really prior to the Clean Air and Clean Water Act, when there were no regulations, everybody certainly had the option to do it voluntarily, and no one exercised.
That's a pretty good argument. How about that, Lynn Scarlett?
You know, what I would say is that our environmental progress is a journey, not a destination. There is always another page to turn and one step further that we can go. In fact, there were the growing efforts in their infancy as people began in the 40s and 30s to be aware that pollution really was a problem. Take my grandpa. He worked in Pittsburgh where there were steel mills, and he actually invented the first air ventilator for steel mills to improve air quality, and it was done on a voluntary basis. Now, as those efforts didn't keep pace with the state of the problem, we ultimately got in the 60s, 70s, and beyond our regulatory approaches. But we think it's time again to turn the page yet one more to one new chapter, and that is to supplement. We're not talking about supplanting, and that's where the caller, I think, is mistaking what I'm saying. We're not talking about getting rid of the regulations, but rather supplementing them and putting our first foot forward with an extended arm of partnership and cooperation. So, for example, you will be seeing in another week or so a big announcement on the climate change front of a number of partnerships with the oil industry and a number of other industries who are going to make hard and fast commitments as an industry to achieve certain greenhouse gas reductions. But they're going to do it in a partnered fashion rather than through prescriptive regulations.
Right, right. Greg, thank you for that. I want to get another call. This one is from Leaf. Leaf from Delafell Field, Wisconsin. Thank you for calling On Point.
Right. Hi, I have a question and a comment, essentially.
Yes.
I have two concerns. One is, does the Bush administration have any perceptual problems as it relates to international perception of the U.S. as dragging its feet on the greenhouse gases and global warming issue? It seems to me that the U.S. should be taking the leadership role on this and not dragging its feet and creating a perception that we need more study and that it takes more time. And clearly there may be other contributing factors other than pollutants as a contributing cause to the global warming issue. But I can tell you here in Wisconsin, we're seeing less and less snow, and I think all parts of the country this is happening. I mean, you see what's happening in the Arctic and Antarctic. There's clearly a problem, and it's certainly most scientists agree that that pollution is a contributing cause. So I'd like to see what the Bush administration, the Republicans, are going to do to address the issue and take a leadership role. And second of all, where has there ever been a historical precedent that shows that voluntarism alone is going to help really solve a lot of the problems that we have as it relates to the issue.
Right. Of course, Lynn is talking partly in some of these areas, if not in global warming, about voluntarism plus. But Lynn Scarlett of the Interior Department, what about this, the United States lagging, the United States perceived as the odd man out on the Kyoto Protocol?
You know, the administration went to the World Summit on Sustainable Development and went with a focus on performance, a focus on results, and a focus on actual hard and fast commitments. And it's partly out of that effort that has come the soon-to-be-announced endeavors by various industries in the United States to affirm that they will achieve specific reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. You know, interestingly, all of the focus on the Kyoto Protocol has tended to focus on that kind of banner phrase without looking beneath it to see where the commitments in action really were occurring. That was a protocol that left out huge chunks of the world, said, okay, they don't need to be players. China, India, for example. And also, frankly, it set broad goals, but when you actually go to see what, in fact, have the other nations of the world been doing, you come up short. Here we are standing up, and in a week or two, you'll see a bunch of industries standing up and saying, put us to the test. This is what we're going to do. That's the kind of performance focus that we're all about.
In other words, these industries are going to say voluntarily, here is what we will do with greenhouse gases.
That's exactly
and
right. But they're going to allow themselves to be measured, to say, here's where we are right now. And yes, we commit in so many, in such a time.
What's their incentive for doing this?
You know, it's a combination, partly of good citizenship and partly the recognition that that if they don't step up to the plate, they may face more prescriptive regulations that are much more difficult to work with. So there's no question, as Brent has pointed out and several callers, that regulations do have a way of having people sort of stand up and think about things. They have played that role over the last three decades. But people keep forgetting that that's not the be-all and end-all. And what our vision is doing is to say, look, that's the tip of the iceberg. Let's look at the rest and see what we can do. Wetlands.
Let's hear from
yeah.
Brent, from Mr. Blackwelder of the Friends of the Earth. Excuse me.
Friends of the Earth has member groups in 70 countries, and we had a big delegation at the World Sustainable Summit in Johannesburg, South Africa. And their perception was that the administration of the United States, the Bush administration, was blocking all progress at environmental sustainability, in particular the ability to get corporations to disclose the kind of toxic ingredients they have. And our member groups think that the United States is arrogant in its walking away from global agreements and trying to go the voluntary route when they have seen some of U.S. corporations be the worst polluters in their countries. And so it's a totally different picture than you're getting from the sort of the verbal sleight of hand that Lynn Scarlett is giving here, that our member groups relate. They are on the ground. They are victims of this pollution.
Let's take another call. Leif, thank you from that. Rebecca is calling from Medford, Mass. Hello and welcome.
Hi, thank you. I sort of have a comment, and I'm curious to hear Mr. Backwelder's views on this. I work in the environmental field, and I know that I recognize the significance of the possible change in EPA's rules about its and the Army Corps' rules about their jurisdictions over wetlands and other waters. And I just want to bring to people's attention that this rule is out for comment over the next couple of months and that they should go ahead and make their views known, and they can get information from the EPA's website and other environmental organizations' websites. And I'm curious about Mr. Blackwelder's views on this issue.
And could you explain what this rule is, just again, just briefly?
I forgot the woman's name, but she had alluded
Lynn Scarlett. This is the new regulation.
Well, it's the new wetlands. It's the new regulation they're promulgating in reference to that Supreme Court case that Lynn Scarlett cited. It was the Solid Waste Agency of Northern Cook County against the Corps of Engineers. But instead of limiting that as they should have, what they've done in the case of wetlands is extremely serious. And what Lynn Scarlett's trying to to hoodwink viewers and think about, well, the volunteer approach has protected all these wetlands. Well, their wetlands are out there, and unless somebody does something to destroy them, they're going to be okay. Whatever we can do to get permanent protection is great, but we don't want to put off limits possibly as many as 20 million acres of wetlands that are not connected directly to a river but are crucial. And hunters and fishermen know how vital these wetlands are. We don't want to open them up
loss. Rebecca is talking about this comment period. What is this, Lynn Scarlett, and how does a citizen make his or her views known?
Whenever the administration or any administration promulgates a new rule, and in this case this was a rule, as Brent said, that we needed to do in the wake of that Supreme Court decision, it goes to what's called the Federal Register, and then is out for people to comment. It goes to the Federal Register in a public and published form. People can go get either a hard copy or go to a website. Regrettably, I don't have the website address right in my head here, but you can go to that published thing, read the rule, and then comment on it, expressing any concerns or any interest, et cetera. I should say, though, that this 20 million figure...
20 million acres
of wetlands not covered as a result of this rule, that kind of popped up out of nowhere, and it is our view that it really is erroneous. The rule is a fairly narrowly focused one, which tries to be consistent with the Supreme Court ruling, but remains leaves intact or recognizes that, for example, tributaries or wetlands flowing adjacent to tributaries that flow into navigable waters are covered by the wetlands mitigation rules. I welcome people commenting, but I think that the 20 million acre figure that's bandied about will be shown to be wildly out of whack.
And your point, Brent, is that this new rule is what? It should not be the rule? Why?
Instead of dealing directly with this case, the administration took an opportunity to greatly restrict the coverage of the Clean Water Act in regards to wetlands, and the experts of all the national environmental groups are pointing to what we all feel is a major change in the coverage of this law, and that 20% of the wetlands, maybe up to 20 million acres, are what are at stake here. And it's nice that we can comment on this one, but I wanted to mention that the Forest Service published a proposal in November, which would exempt forest planning from the National Environmental Policy Act and prohibit public participation in the form of petitions or form letters or postcards signed on. And so,
hold that thought, Brent. We'll be right back. Lynn, are you going to stay with us for a couple more minutes?
I can just stay a few more minutes.
That's great.
Then I got to go.
Okay. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're grading the Bush environmental record 2 years in this hour. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Lynn Scarlett, Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Policy Management and Budget, and Brent Blackwelder, who's the President of the Friends of the Earth. Lynn Scarlett, let me lay it on the line. I just hear in what you're saying and what the administration people are saying a lot of just uncandor. Instead of saying to us, look, we believe that the carapace of regulation is just weighing the economy down, and we can give you facts and figures. You've got a guy in the OMB, Mr. Graham, who specializes in that, who specializes in showing that regulation actually increases the cost of everything. And we can't really afford that anymore, so we're going to soften these regulations, and we're going to grow the economy. And with the growth in the economy, then we can deal with regulatory stuff. But really, you know, we have to be clear that these regulations have not been market friendly. It's cost our economy. We can't afford it, and we won the election.
Jack, the record just doesn't show that. You know, again, if you look at the diesel rule that I described, if you look at the Clean Skies Initiative, it is a regulatory initiative. It will yield 35 million tons of reductions in pollutants. But what this administration does think is that it is time to look beyond regulations as the sole tool in the toolbox and turn our attention to things like our Partners for Fish and Wildlife program, which protects five times as many wetlands, for example, as the wetlands mitigation program that Brent has so focused on. You know, and I could go down the line.
But isn't it true that really you all think that regulation has been a kind of dead hand on the economy?
You know, Jack, my own view is that environmental progress is extraordinarily important. It goes hand in glove with economic well-being, and we can do these both together. But doing them together does mean broadening that toolkit. It does mean looking for those conservation partnerships. You know, Interior manages one in every 5 acres of the United States. Think about it. 20% of the United States, we're the nation's premier conservation agency, and we're pouring millions of dollars into those acres to try and repair them, rehabilitate them, restore them, protect them. But we're also partnering up with our neighbors because we know that environment knows no jurisdiction. It knows no boundaries. We've got to partner with farmers, with ranchers, with miners, with the whole suite of folks that are out there on the landscape. And that's going to take tools more than just the regulatory tools that have been the centerpiece and the focus and the preoccupation of 3 decades of what I refer to as the old environmentalism. We've got to turn the page forward. That's what we're trying to do. And I think that the record of whether you're talking our conservation programs, where we have the largest budget ever, for example, for our wildlife refuges in the history of the United States. We have a large conservation grant set of programs, Farm Bill added to that as it related to partnerships with farmers. These are major, major initiatives, major commitments to environmental protection, coupled with a continued commitment to ensure compliance with the regulations that we have, but also do them smart. And so we're using new tools like tradable permits in our Clean Skies Act. That's the vision we're setting forward.
Lynn, I know we have to let you go, and thank you for joining us.
Happy to be with you. Good night, Brent.
Lynn Scarlett is the Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Policy, Management, and Budget. Let's take a call from Michael.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Hi. I work in the environmental field. I actually worked at EPA until about 2 years ago as an enforcement counsel. And I didn't really want to get into Ms. Scarlett's verbal sleight of hand about statistics, about clean air and clean water, because, you know, my own review of the new regulations or proposed regulations indicate that there's definitely been a weakening. But she seemed to hang her hat quite a bit on the voluntary component of environmental protection.
Yes.
And from, you know, I still talk to a lot of my friends at EPA, and there's no question that the enforcement budget has been cut drastically. And, you know, companies just are, if there isn't the enforcement stick to make companies go into a voluntary program, there's no real incentive for them to do so.
And yet you're saying the enforcement, the agents, the money committed to that is being weakened in this administration.
Weakened, yes. And shifted to other places that aren't so, in other areas that aren't so enforcement oriented.
The caller is absolutely correct, right on target. In fact, under the Bush administration, EPA has initiated 50% fewer enforcement actions against polluters than under the Clinton administration. Enforcement is a key, and Lynn Scarlett, again, was trying to deceive us because we are in for a big budgetary cut on many domestic programs, but environment in particular, as we move forward into this year. So it's not looking good, especially on the crucial area of enforcement.
Michael, have you seen cases where if it weren't for the law, we would have a much worse situation where essentially active inspection and so on save the environment?
Oh, no question. There's no question. And frankly, I was reviewing the proposed wetlands, proposed rulemaking regulations or whatever, the proposed rulemaking today and read the guidance that went along with it. And there's no question that, you know, now I'm in private practice and obviously I can't comment on it, but, you know, in private practice, you're licking your chops when you're reading this because it obviously will affect a lot of companies as far as jurisdictional issues where they'll be able to assert that EPA has no jurisdiction over their activities.
Hmm. Michael, thank you. Let's take a quick last call from Eric in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hello, welcome.
Thanks a lot. My name is Eric. I'm with CP PAC, the Peace Group in Boston. Mm-hmm. I'd like to mention Bush's desire to go to war with Iraq. I can't imagine anything more destructive than war, environmentally and otherwise, between scorched earth, destroyed factories, and exploding bombs, to mention that oil is a major reason for our dangerous policies in the Middle East, and also consider the billions of dollars that would be spent on war and how much better that money could be spent on mass transit, clean energy, and other domestic programs.
Eric, we thank you for that. Brent Blackwell, just in conclusion, this administration is not – how is it that at the Republican National Convention, even people who identified themselves as conservatives also identified themselves as environmentalists? How is it that the Bush record, which I think you've laid out pretty objectively and which your literature lays out exhaustively, how is it that that's acceptable since so many people in the country call themselves environmentalists? I mean, where's the – you know, how is that working, even with Republicans who are environmentalists?
Well, the administration talks one thing. We're protecting the environment through voluntary actions. But they're doing another thing. They are actually weakening in the Federal Register all the regulations that implement our basic laws, and we've enumerated those. Mm-hmm. They're weakening it by not enforcing the law. They're weakening it actually by cutting the budget. And this administration is different from other Republican administrations. Under Bush's father, we had a major change and improvement in the Clean Air Act. His father put in place the no net loss of wetlands. Under President Nixon, we scored major victories in the National Environmental Policy Act and the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts. Those people appointed individuals to head the agencies that cared about what they were doing. Right now, at the Interior Department, we have the number two guy, Stephen Griles, who is coming right from the coal, oil, gas industries that he represented, and he's violated his recusal agreement by meeting with them not just once or twice, but several dozen times. So they're doing the public's business for the private gain, for the polluters who they really worked for before they came into public office. It's the fox guarding the chicken coop.
Brent
right
Blackwelder.
Now. That's what's happening.
Brent, thank you so much. Brent Blackwelder is the president of the Friends of the Earth. He's been an environmental lobbyist for 33 years. Continue the conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, remembering legendary artist Al Hirschfeld, this is On Point. Legendary caricaturist Al Hirschfeld passed away today at the age of 99. Hirschfeld became renowned for his sketches from the theater world that captured scenes and characters, as well as critics' words. The theater community took Hirschfeld in as one of its own. His work was honored with a special Tony Award, and next year he'll become the first visual artist to have a Broadway theater named after him. When his daughter Nina was born in 1945, Hirschfeld began hiding her name in his drawings, maybe in the fold of a dress or a kink of her hair. Searching for Ninas became such a popular pastime for readers of the New York Times that whenever he omitted a Nina, he was inundated with letters from frustrated readers asking where the Nina was hidden. The military even used the hidden Ninas to train bomber pilots to spot targets. David Leopold has been Al Hirschfeld's archivist for the past 13 years. In this radio diary, he reflects on the life and career of Al Hirschfeld.
I think everybody knows Hirschfeld's drawings. Whether they're aware of Hirschfeld's name is another thing. His drawings have appeared in just about every publication on just about anything that has been able to print anything for the last 80 years, actually more than 80 years. His drawings have appeared in newspapers, magazines, book covers, CDs, DVDs, online, on billboards, just about any place you can imagine. He really changed the nature of caricature. You know, when we think of caricature, we think of something pejorative, and I think really before Hirschfeld, it is really a very pejorative genre. But with Hirschfeld and some of his contemporaries, they take the sort of meanness out of it and replace it with this sort of celebration of the performer. He one time said that he took the character created by the playwright and as interpreted by the actor and reinvented it for the reader. And that's what he was so good at. His drawings, even though he drew celebrities and performers who are notorious in taking umbrage at how they're viewed, no one ever complained about a Hirschfeld drawing. Well, actually, one person complained. Alan Funt of Candid Camera complained that Hirschfeld made him look like a gorilla. And Hirschfeld responded, "That's not my doing. That's God's work." He did not practice anatomical distortion. No, there were no big heads and little bodies, exaggerated noses or ears. He didn't bring out the worst in people. He really brought out the best in people. Because of that, everyone looked forward to his drawings, not only readers and publishers, but producers and performers. It was a sign you had arrived on the scene when Hirschfeld drew your portrait. He was really an engaging guy. I mean, his drawings are a real accurate reflection of who he was. This mixture, you know, on the face of it, his drawings look very simple. But, of course, the more you look at them, the more sophisticated they become. And that's who he was as an individual. He had this constant wonder about life. I mean, the seal of approval from Hirschfeld is when he declared something was insane. He loved the absurdities of life. His life was full of characters who were sometimes larger than life and sometimes just absolutely nuts. He just loved life and all the people in it. He didn't spend 82 years or so studying landscape. He studied people. He would frequently go down to the Howard Johnson's in Times Square and sit at a window booth and just draw people as they were walking by because he just loved people. That is something that I think makes his drawings so remarkable and so engaging for a viewer, even, you know, 20, 30, 70 years after they were drawn, because this is obviously somebody who has an affection for humanity. You know, people want to make a great fuss of the fact that he was 99. Well, he was no more 99 than you or I are. He was really someone who was immune to time. He didn't act 99, didn't think 99. He did look back. You know, this was a man who, you know, his friends would come up there, and they might want to talk about the past, and Hirschfeld was always, you know, with his friends. He talked about anything they wanted to talk about. But I remember one time a fellow left the studio, and Hirschfeld turned to me and says, "I don't understand these guys who want to live in the past." You know, he was very much in the present day, and he was interested in what was going on now and maybe what was opening a little bit later on in the season.
David Leopold is the archivist for legendary caricaturist Al Hirschfeld. Hirschfeld died today at age 99. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you.